UK Wine Show, show number 140, The Terroir of Marlborough. On this week's wine show, we're talking with Neil Phillips on the terroir and the differences within Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc.
And in the news, Australia set to lose last of Europe's wine names. Asda wine goes to Japan, and wine drinking will slow but still grow in the UK.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 140 for the 23rd of January 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Neil Phillips. Neil works for Pernod Ricard, one of the biggest wine companies in the world, and Pernod are the owners of Montana, New Zealand's largest wine company, and the people who invented modern-day New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. We talked with Neil about the terroir of Marlborough and Sauvignon Blanc. In the spotlight, we continue looking at the science of wine tasting. This week, we're looking at our mouth and trying to understand how that works. And this week's quote is, "I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy." I like that one. Who said that? Clues throughout the show? Answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The Australian wine industry will soon phase out the last of the traditional European names that are still in use for its wines, but were agreed to be replaced under the Trade in Wine Agreement, the TWA, which was made between the European Community and Australia in 1993. The term sherry is now going to be replaced with apera, and tokai will become topaic. Apera is apparently a play on aperitif and will be relaunched as a trendy, fun wine to drink when the sun goes down. Topaic, meanwhile, according to the makers, sounds more refined than tokai. New descriptors for fino and flor still need to be found and are due to be announced next month by the Winemakers Federation of Australia. In exchange, the EC will recognise winemaking techniques used in Australia but banned in Europe, such as oak chips and staves. Australian producers have been phasing out European names and expressions since 1993, and in many cases they've done this before the agreed dates. Beaujolais, Cava and Frascati were among the first to be removed, and Champagne hasn't been used for several years. The WFA said the new names for sherry and tokai had been identified during a market research project which cost $1 million Australian.
$1 million? That's a lot of money to be spent on a name. But if it keeps the Aussies happy, fair enough. As has been in the news, Jane, what's going on there?
Well, four of their wines from the extra special own label brand are to be launched in 40 stores in Japan, which are operated by Seiyu, a subsidiary of Asda's parent company Walmart. The Japanese retailer will be listing Chenin Blanc, Pinotage, Claret and Medoc wines, which will sell for around 700 to 1,000 yen, which is the equivalent of £5 to £8 in the UK. Seiyu say that wine is becoming more popular in Japan, particularly amongst women, and that UK-branded products are well received.
Cheers, Jane. With Japanese increasing their drinking, what's going on in the UK? Are we still drinking more?
Well, apparently wine drinking will slow, but will still grow. That's according to new data from Wine and Spirit exhibition organiser Vinexpo. In the 5 years from 2003 to 2007, wine drinking in Britain grew more than 12%. And Britain overtook Germany as the world's biggest wine importer. But forecasts based on the next 5 years, from 2008 to 2012, show that growth will continue at a much slower rate of just over 6%. These predictions are based on research from the International Wine and Spirit Record, which analyses global trends. The IWSR also monitors spirit sales, which are predicted to be up by nearly 6% in the UK by 2012. Vodka has overtaken whisky as the nation's favourite spirit, and consumption's expected to increase by a further 20%. That's all from me this week, but remember you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. I was at the Bibendum wine tasting on Wednesday. Bibendum are a wholesaler servicing most of the segments of the industry, restaurants, independents, and multiples such as supermarkets. I was talking to an English producer whose name I won't divulge, but he thought the UK restaurant industry was struggling. Wine volumes may go up in the long term, but I think the value of wine will go down, particularly from higher margin wines sold in restaurants. Next up, we have the spotlight. This week, we're looking at the mouth and the science behind how we taste. The need to taste is most likely a genetic trait to ensure that we eat foods that are good for us and don't poison us. So while it might sound strange, most of the flavour we taste in our mouths are not coming from our mouths, but from our noses. Flavours travel through the back of the mouth and up to our noses. Our mouths only taste a limited number of sensations. And not everybody tastes the same. Different cultures have different descriptions for the effects in the mouth. Salt, sweet, sour, and bitterness. Where sour in wine refers to acidity, and bitterness is often associated with tannins in wine. The Japanese include umami and kokum, where umami is a meatiness or savouriness, and kokum is a richness or weight, most likely in wine's case caused by alcohol. Not often covered by different cultures is a metallic taste in your mouth, often associated with the taste of blood. And some scientists have shown that mice, and possibly humans, have receptors in the mouth for fatty acids and calcium. But what is a receptor? Taste receptors work by a chemical reaction causing nerve impulses to go to the brain. But how these impulses is created and travel to the brain vary. Salt and sour are detected by the presence of ions that interacts with proteins in what is called the ion channels. These control the voltage across cell membranes, which eventually form a signal. Salt uses sodium ions, while sour uses hydronium ions that are formed from acids and water. Sweet, umami, and bitterness use a series of receptors called G-protein-coupled receptors. These are a grouping of proteins that sense molecules outside the cell and activate signals inside. The human genome encodes roughly 350 G-protein-coupled receptors, which detect hormones, growth factors, and taste. Approximately 150 of these G-protein-coupled receptors found in the human genome are not known what functions they do, and could easily be taste sensations below our conscious threshold. For example, in Western culture, umami is not considered a taste, but in Japan, umami, the savoury flavour, is a taste of meatiness, and is triggered by amino acids found in the protein-rich foods such as meats, cheese, and fish. In wines, it's associated with the breakdown or autolysis of yeast, so is most likely to be found in sparkling wines, which have been aged on the lees for at least 3 years, and fino sherries, which have been aged under the floor. Salt particularly highlights umami, which may be why salty foods go well with champagne and fino sherries, which I think finos go beautifully with roasted salted almonds. Another receptor in the mouth has the sexy title of CD36 receptor. It's a fat receptor, or more importantly, fatty acids such as omega-3. You may not notice it when you're eating it, but your brain notices it and triggers gastric juices to digest the acids. But more work is required to determine if there's a taste relationship for fats. The sensation of temperature is very important to wine. Many wines are hot. That is, they have a hot, spicy character to them. In wine, it's caused by the alcohol, but the reaction is the same for a high-temperature dish or a hot, spicy chili, for example. Hot is not technically a taste, because the signal is carried to the brain by a different set of nerves called trigeminal nerves, which also involves information about other parts of the body, such as the nasal cavity or under fingernails. But the pain temperature sensors, known as polymodal nociceptors, do give a physical reaction to the alcohol in wine. Given that the taste is based on chemical reactions, you think that the taste of salt or sour does not change. In fact, this is not the case. In recent work by Barry Green on thermal taste, or how we taste with temperature, as Barry has shown, for example, individuals sensitive to salt will notice that an ice cube touched on the tip of their tongue for a few seconds will begin to taste salty. Unfortunately, thermal taste probably does not affect the taste of foods and beverages because the temperature conditions that produce it are rarely encountered during eating or drinking. Another example of how our tastes become confused is eating the miracle berry or miracle fruit. This berry, once chewed, converts the taste of sour to sweet. Eating a small part of the berry makes lime juice taste rich and very sweet. The effect lasts between 30 minutes and 2 hours. And while the exact cause for this is unknown, one hypothesis is the effect may change or distort the shape of sweetness receptors, so that they become responsive to acids instead of sugars, making things taste sweet. One common mistake is to believe that around your mouth you taste different things. For example, sweet at the front, acidity at the side, tannins or bitterness at the back. Now, while it's considered to be true in the wine industry, most people studying taste sensations do not believe it. I think it's one of those old wives' tales that's just got out. That ends this week's spotlight. Next week, we finish looking at the science of wine by looking at how we perceive aroma. But how are you getting on with the quote? I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. It's a great quote. Short and witty, the best types. It was said by an American singer-songwriter, composer, and actor with a distinctive voice, and he has a distinctive voice. Described by the critic Daniel DeColes, sounding like it was soaked in a vat of bourbon, left hanging in a smokehouse for a few months, then taken outside and run over. I've had a listen to some of his music, and I think that's a fairly good description. His songs are best known to the general public in the form of cover versions by more famous artists. For example, Jersey Girl was performed by Bruce Springsteen, Downtown Train performed by Rod Stewart, and I don't know this one, but OI-55 or OI-55 performed by the Eagles. Any ideas about who he is? To be honest, I didn't know who he was, so I listened to a couple of songs, and he's pretty good. I think it's the type of music that Neil Phillips would like. Next up, we have the interview with Neil. Neil works with Pernod Ricard, one of the biggest wine companies in the world, and Pernod are the owners of Montana, New Zealand's largest wine company. Let's have a listen to what Neil has to say about the terroir of Marlborough. Hi, I'm here with Neil Phillips from Pernod Ricard. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Chris. How are you?
I'm excellent. Excellent indeed. We're going to be talking a wee bit about terroir and Sauvignon Blanc terroir in New Zealand and specifically. But do you want to just give us a quick overview of what you do and how you fit within the big Pernod Ricard? Because they're one of the biggest wine companies in the world.
They certainly are. And the way I fit into Pernod Ricard is I actually look after all the premium wines in the Pernod Ricard business in the UK. So to give you some examples on that, for example, with Montana, we have our Montana Lettuce Series, I'll look after that. Also, say with Jacob's Creek, on one of the major brands like that, we have a heritage range which starts at £15. And within that, we're actually selling to not only retailers but also to on-trade outlets. We're selling to independent wine merchants as well. And we're also including that our champagne portfolio of Perrier-Jouët and Mumm.
Mm-hmm. What does your job entail? Does it go around talking to premium
part of my job is media based, so I do a lot of radio. In terms of representing the company's brands, I do a lot of the consumer shows, for example. I love doing those. I love doing shows like the wine show. I've got the Tesco Wine Fair coming up. I really enjoy those. It's a great opportunity to get some feedback from consumers, and also it's interesting to see where consumers have actually got in terms of their understanding of what's happening. And in addition to that, I go out with the sales team and I act effectively as an ambassador and do the tastings with some of the key customers as well.
Oh, excellent. Nice job.
So great job, yeah. I really enjoy it.
I think the listeners should know I've been doing a wee bit of work with you. We've been doing video work.
We've had a great time, actually.
Tasting some
wine. Chris and Neil show.
But we want to crack into Sauvignon Blanc, really, because one of the nice things about Montana's Lettuce Series is that you're growing grapes in different areas and trying to get the expression of those regions.
We are. And what actually happened was, I mean, in terms of Montana, you know, it was an inspired moment in actually saying there was, in terms of growing Sauvignon Blanc in Marlborough and being the first people to do that and producing the first vintage of Montana Sauvignon Blanc in 1979. But as time progressed, it realised that actually within Marlborough, you've got these different sub-regions and actually you're getting out different characteristics there, Chris. And so that was something we decided, actually, what we wanted to do with those three sub-regions in terms of Ripara, Brancott and Awatere, just taking those different characteristics, it's produced three different wines, one from each of those districts. And it's great fun to show those to people.
Yeah, let's just talk about those three regions first.
Yeah.
You said Ripara.
Yeah.
No, let's start off with where Ripara is, where Brancott is, and Awatere.
Yeah, so they're all part of Marlborough. And what you've got there in terms of Ripara, you've got that in the North Wairau Valley. Then you move to Brancott, which is south of that, the South Wairau Valley.
That's just on the foothills, isn't
it? Yes, that's just on the foothills. And then you go southeast of Brancott, and you're actually going down to Awatere, which is the newest of those three wine regions. I think that's about 30 kilometres away, something like that.
Yeah, it looks about that. I was having a good look on Google Maps. Have you ever seen Google Maps?
No, I haven't actually.
I tell you what, you can zoom in and it shows the grapevines and it lowers you in and you can get like a side view looking at the mountain.
Oh, hey, that's
if you've
cool.
If you've never ever done it, type in Marlborough into Google Maps and Google Earth. You can see the hills in the background. Oh, it's fantastic.
Hey, I'm going to do that. I think it's very interesting because even though they're not that far away from each other, really, these three regions, but it's the different characteristics you actually get out of there, because we found that actually with Rapara, we were getting some of those sort of tropical fruits mixed up with the gooseberry as well. They're picking a bit earlier there. You know, the sun shines onto those stones. The stones reflect then onto the vines and the grapes, and it speeds up the ripening process. And you get quite a lot of intensity there.
So Rapara it's the old river, White River riverbed,
isn't it?
So
it is.
Gravelly. It seems to be quite large pebble stones.
They are very large pebble, smooth sunstones, they call them. And they have this tremendous effect there.
What are they doing? Are they heating up or cooling down?
They're heating. You know, in the daytime, what they're doing is they're reflecting that heat onto the vines. So they're warming the vines up, warming those grapes and vines up, and that's speeding up that ripening process, getting that intensity. But obviously, at nighttime, it cools down. But what it does is it actually means that there's a danger where you can almost get too much ripeness, and it just gets that coolness in there. So you're going to get that acidity and that balance with the wines from there as well, which is really attractive, I think.
And then the next area, Brancock, or not so much Brancock, it's more South Huara.
Yeah, it's more South Huara, Chris. You know, there it's a little bit drier, a bit cooler. They're picking a little bit later there. And some of the things that we found there as well was actually just identifying almost a bit of cut grass there, capsicum as well, those sort of flavours coming out of there as well. Very interesting.
The soils are a bit more clayey.
Yes.
They're a bit heavier and... To me, when I've been tasting some of the wines we've been tasting recently, what I've noticed is it's a real textural feel.
Yeah.
The South Wairau has a heaviness to it that maybe the Rapara doesn't.
I would agree with that. And I think this is one of the things that makes it just very attractive for people to pick out these differences. And they are very distinct differences, I think, between these subregions. And then you move on in terms of the Awatere, which is very cool, very dry, quite challenging in terms of actually production there and getting decent yields. And that's that there, you know, and people think you're going crazy when you start talking about picking up characteristics like tomato stalk there. Mm. And you've got is that the stones, you've got clay there as well. And I think there's some really interesting characteristics which you get out of Awatere.
From a terroir point of view.
Yes.
You've got Rapara, which is probably the warmest.
Yes.
Then you've got the South Wairau, which is sort of middle ground,
yes,
but with heavier soils.
Yes.
And then you're getting into Awatere, which is again cooler, but with similar silty, heavy style soils.
Yeah? Yes, that's right, yeah.
Okay, and the Rapara, you're getting the riper fruits, probably because of the extra heat.
Yes.
And then as you move down, you're getting more textural in the South Wairau, and then Awatere, you're getting into that. You were saying it was tomato.
Yeah, tomato, yeah. And I think actually with the Awatere, that usually takes for me a little bit longer to come around. It's usually a bit more close at the beginning. But I find it quite a weighty Sauvignon Blanc from there. And certainly a really good food Sauvignon Blanc style.
I'm quite convinced now that you can get a textural feel,
yes,
from the soils.
Yes.
You know, we've spoken to people like Simon Waghorn, who's a producer down there. He's Astrolabe in Whitehaven. And he's gone through the typical ripening process of a Sauvignon Blanc in terms of flavour profiles. You're saying that the flavours are different, but it sounds like it's more about where you pick on that continuum. So we talked about Awatere being the coolest.
Yes.
So maybe the flavours just haven't progressed as far by the time you pick.
I think that, yeah, I think there's a lot in that, because clearly, you know, you've got that ripeness coming and we want to get that balance right as well. But we are really also trying to say, you know, we want the vineyard to do the talking here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we wanted to do with actually producing these three wines. That was the key thing for us, so that we could get those key characteristics out there. But clearly, you know, we have different periods of time where we're going to be harvesting that, and that clearly has an impact as well.
Do you think there's much variation from season to season? Yeah, we talked about Awatere being cooler than Rapara by far, significantly cooler, but compared with South Wairau in the middle. Do you think if you had a cold season, you might see South Wairau taking on the Awatere sort of flavour spectrum? Or have you noticed that? Or do you think it's less about that?
I think it's less about that, actually, because I've seen several vintages now of this Montana Terroir range, and I've felt as though they have been much more... They've clearly, despite, you know, differences, obviously, vintage to vintage, but they've still come back to me and been very much three distinct styles of wine. And I felt as though when I've shown that to consumers as well, that's sort of been their feedback. They're picking up these three different styles, different flavour components in there. So I think it's less affected by that, really.
What I'm trying to get to is, if it's not the temperature difference that's driving those changes, and I'm not necessarily convinced about the soils driving the changes, I'm trying to work out what it is. One of the key things with Marlborough is warm days, cold nights.
Yes.
You know, not freezing cold, but cool nights helps to maintain the acidity.
Absolutely.
Do you think that change in temperature changes from Rapara to South Wairau to Awatere?
Oh, I think it does, and I think it does mean there's more challenges with that as well, actually, about getting that ripeness as well sometimes, because Awatere, I know there have been occasions when, in terms of the actual yields, the yields have been lower because it's just been much more challenging there getting that ripeness, because it has been cool in the day as well, obviously being cool at night time as well. And clearly that's presented, you know, much more difficulties down there than it does in Rapara, which, is, as we know, is warmer and probably easier, really, to manage in that respect.
What's the common blending? Because it seems to me that you've got a natural blending partners between Rapara and Awatere. You know, Awatere probably has more of a freshness and acidity. Rapara, more of the riper fruits. They seem like a natural blending component to try and even it out. If you're a producer and you're trying to get a more consistency from year to year?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for example, with the Montana Classic, you know, what we're doing now is actually, you know, blending from all those three sub-regions. And even with, for example, say in Brancott, Montana Brancott now, in terms of the letter series, you know, our finest Sauvignon Blanc that we produce, one of the things we do add a little bit of our Awatere fruit in there as well, because we feel it just gives that lift. So we've learnt actually where we can use parcels from different sub-regions and actually that contribution it can make into each Sauvignon Blanc we're producing.
A completely different area now.
Yeah.
Hawke's Bay.
Yes.
Hawke's Bay, Marlborough, Montana still do some... you've got a North Island Sauvignon Blanc, haven't you?
Yes, we do some work there, but we're more probably focused on doing some different things there now, like Pinot Grigio, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That seems to be the big one.
Yeah, it does actually, yeah.
Why are you not growing Pinot Gris or not much Pinot Gris down in Marlborough?
We're starting to grow a bit more, and we're actually going to, interesting enough, because we launched the Montana Pinot Grigio 2007 vintage, and it's been a great success because people have just said, hey, wow, we love Pinot Grigio, but they like the minerality they're getting out of the Pinot Grigio.
Slightly spicy as well.
Slightly spicy. But what we've done with the 2008, we've actually got some Marlborough Pinot Gris in there as well, blended with the North Island, and we are going to grow more Pinot Gris so we can expand that sort of Pinot Grigio, because there's a great demand, but actually we think actually just adding that bit of Marlborough fruit in there is really important as well.
Hawke's Bay,
yeah,
obviously you think Pinot Gris is going to be a big one out there, but there is a wee bit of Sauvignon Blanc up there. What's that called, and what's the key definition of that style?
I think what you're getting there is a more, we have a Church Row winery up there, which produces, by the way, a fantastic wine called Tom, which is a Bordeaux blend, actually. Just have to mention that. It's absolutely brilliant.
What is it, Sémillon, Sauvignon?
It's a red, actually. Sorry, it's a red of a Cab Sauve. And we also had a bit of Merlot in there and a little bit of Malbec.
I thought that might have been a tongue-in-cheek at the old French calling New Zealand Sauvignon. Taste of the old Tom.
Yeah, well, I know. It sounded like it was going to be that. But we do produce a little bit of Sauvignon Blanc up there. But it's actually quite a restrained style, probably quite old-fashioned, and almost in some ways for some people, I think it's quite European in style, more so than probably what we're producing down in Marlborough. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, you know, we've obviously got a lot of the work we're doing up there with Chardonnay, clearly in North Island, also some Pinot Noir, but Pinot Grigio is a big focus for us now on North Island.
Just finishing up on talking about terroir,
I've
slowly come around to the conclusion that if you've got the right climate to grow grapes on clay or clay dominated, you do get a more textural feel in the wine. It's been a slow evolution because people talk about lots of stuff and it's very hard to prove it or disprove it, but I've seen enough wines now where I think clay does create a fatness in the wine. Have you seen that sort of difference maybe with other regions or sub-regions, either in New Zealand or anywhere in the world, really, because you've got a bit of experience in other places?
I think I agree with you, Chris, because actually I do think you get that bit of weight and in that intensity. Actually, I think you get that in New Zealand. I think definitely that comes through for me, and I find that really attractive, actually, because I think you tend to get that more, that fruit intensity, a little bit of darker fruits on the nose there, certainly coming through. And I think, you know, we've actually... with our terroir, in terroir series now, we've done some Pinot Noirs as well. We've got three different Pinot Noirs to sort of extend that out as well. And I think some of the characteristics we're getting through there, but I really like Central Otago, obviously.
Hey.
You're there. You're from there, but not just because of that, because I think there's some of the wines there are really coming out in a really good style. But definitely clay, I think, has got quite an influence, actually.
All right, then, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much for your time, Neil.
It's a pleasure, Chris. See you soon.
I record the interview with Neil in late November when we were getting deep into terroir. Next week, we're going to be talking with Matthew Dickinson from Terry's. Terry's are an importer of French wines into the UK. We talked to Matthew about changes and the future of French wine. But before we close, let's finish up with who said the quote, "I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy." Well, this week, it's a blues jazz singer and an Academy Award nominee for his work in the soundtrack One from the Heart. We're talking about Tom Waits. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.